The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Dennis J. Turner. He joins us on the telephone near Traverse City, Michigan. His new book is called An American Yankee in King Alfred's Court. And the last time we had him on the show was for his book, What Did You Do in the War, Sister? Welcome back to the program, Dennis.
Well, thank you for having me, Vic.
Dennis, I finished reading your book. And when I got to the end, I started looking at some other stuff, and that's when I realized that this is not a memoir, that I was reading fiction.
Yes, that is correct. It started out as being a memoir, nonfiction, but a couple of issues sort of sent me down the fiction route. One is that the privacy laws in England are much stricter than in America. And there was concern that some of the comments I made about some of the characters would come back to haunt me and the publisher. And the other one is the fictional format gave me a lot more flexibility to create a story arc and to pull in some cases that we did not actually try ourselves, but barristers that I had other associations with had been involved with.
Okay. Well, Dennis, before we get into this actual story, let our listeners know who you are, what your background is, and how you got yourself into a position to even observe this world.
Okay. I am a law professor from the University of Dayton, and I was one of the original five law faculty that started the law school back in 1974. And so it was, this came about, my opportunity to work with British barristers came about initially in 1993 when I was at a law school convention and chatting with another professor who said he was also a barrister. And I said, oh, gee, that sounds interesting. How did you do that? And before you know it, he said, well, if you're interested, I will send your resume to the chambers that I was associated with in England. And he did. And at that point, I didn't think anything would come of it. And a month later, I got a letter from a barrister by the name of Jeffrey Still, who said, I'll take you on as a pupil. And then I had to make the decision to take my family over to England for 6 months. And we did a 1994 pupillage, and we did it again in 2001 with Jeffrey. And we tried a lot of cases together. I basically sat second chair, advising and commenting on theory of the case and evidentiary issues and other matters. So that's how it came about.
As we read the book, we discover that there are many differences between a barrister in the UK and an attorney in the United States. For one thing, that's very different. The way that they look at the law, the way that they conduct trials, the way they conduct cross-examinations, there's so many differences, and we learn about these in your book.
Well, I was very surprised. I thought that the rules of evidence and procedure and the way criminal trials were conducted would be very much the same as ours, since our system is a spinoff from the British system. And so I was actually pleasantly surprised to see the differences and seeing that some of the process and their system is better than ours. And I, you know, kind of grew up thinking the American criminal justice system is sort of the gold standard, and it was enlightening to see no, it could be improved.
Your fictional barrister who you shadow, you indicated that he's inspired by your actual barrister who you accompanied in real life, Jeffrey Still. How close do you adhere? Was Jeffrey Still fairly similar to this gentleman, or did you take some artistic license here?
No, he was similar. I think I've captured Jeffrey pretty well, and even some members of his family think that I have done that. He was a larger-than-life person. He had a huge ego, and yet somehow we managed to get along and become friends. And that is part of the story that amazed me, is that I can never imagine being friends with someone like Jeffrey in this country, but somehow we became good friends.
In your novel, this fellow is quite the mover and shaker, and he's quite the entrepreneur and the bon vivant. Tell us about him. Tell us about this fictional guy's personality.
Well, he is very confident. He was a brilliant lawyer and in the courtroom, but he was very much an entrepreneur, especially when it came to buying properties, rehabbing them, and reselling them. He also owned some property in Normandy that he marketed with timeshares, and his renovation of these places were just amazing. He would never do cheap work. It always had to be the best, and they turned out really profitable for him, except for the one instance, which is related in the book, which is based on reality pretty much, in which he had a deal going to his biggest project is a 100-room chateau in Normandy, and he failed to get the owner to re-up the option to buy for another 6 months, and the owner backed out at the last minute. So that did not work out so well for Giles in the book and for Jeffrey in real life.
But it worked out okay for you, according to the novel, because you were thinking about investing in this, right?
Yes, I don't know if it worked out all right. This was a case in which both Kathy and I started lusting over having the thought of having a boat hole there in France for future travels. And we actually got too eager to get involved. And then when the fell through, we were more crushed than we probably should have been. But, you know, it was a lesson for me, too, is that you shouldn't set your hopes up on something too much, especially material things, because sometimes they disappear.
Tell us what it was like in your novel to ride along in a car with this fellow driving.
Well, it was an experience, and you have to not look at the speedometer. You assume that if he lived this long, traveling at this speed, talking in a cell phone, and has survived, that you're probably going to survive too. And we would be conducting business while he's roaring along about 85 miles an hour. And of course, he's always late, so he's always rushing. And so it you just have to assume that you're going to make it, because if you worry too much, it would be, you know, just too traumatic to really think about it.
And this guy in the book is also quite a Casanova, and he had this amazing ability to have all these different girlfriends, and they never hated him later. Tell us about that.
Well, he was amazing that way. He had all these affairs, girlfriends, have called what you want, and they always remain friends. And I think that is because they knew themselves that this arrangement was never going to be a lasting one. And when you're with Jeffrey, he focuses on you and makes you feel so special as a woman. He's interested in your life and just keeping making you happy and introducing you to new things. You knew you were going to eat well and so they never resented it when the affair ended. And in fact, many of them would say it was just a good thing. Jeffrey is not a person you can expect to have a long-term relationship with. And one of the women that I talked to said, well, he was the most selfish, generous man I've ever met.
You describe him as a narcissist.
A narcissist that you could poke holes in or and give a hard time to, and didn't take such, inflated view of himself that you could hurt his feelings. you could say these things out to him, and he usually had some response to that, but it was all, he wasn't the narcissist that we now know, some narcissist that can't take even the slightest bit of humor directed at him, but he could do that. And I think that helped our relationship too, is I realized that I could give him a hard time and it was fine.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. I've been joined by Dennis J. Turner. His novel is An American Yankee in King Alfred's Court. Let's talk about some of these trials. One thing that's interesting about this to me, and I was sort of aware of this because I've watched a lot of Rumpole. Trials, you could be on either side. You could be a defense attorney or a prosecutor, which is, in the United States, that's kind of an unusual concept, isn't it?
Yes, it just doesn't happen in the States. At one point in after having experienced this, I did try to talk to the local bar association and that to have maybe an exchange between prosecutors and public defenders for 6 months, because you know what it does? It creates an aura of civility between the sides, because you're not going to do things as a prosecutor that next week they could be turned against you when you're defense.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't try to pull those kind of tricks. And I thought that helped the much more civil aspect of the British trial.
And this fellow, he really was mentoring you. He wanted you to have a better appearance. He didn't like your wardrobe. He tried to encourage you to upgrade your wardrobe. Now, I don't know if this happened in real life, but in the book, this is fairly hilarious, and I don't think it's a spoiler to tell our listeners where he suggested you could get yourself a nice suit and where these suits came from.
Yes. Well, he thought I should have a Savile Row suit, and of course I did know enough about Savile Row to know that they're $10,000 suits and that. And so Jeffrey did get his suits from a Savile Row tailor, but they were sort of used because the tailor had an arrangement with many of the local undertakers in London to buy the suits that a deceased wore in the casket. And the families often didn't want those back. I mean, and they're usually very good suits. So they would buy the suits and then they would sell them to somebody who was interested in buying them, and they would then tailor it to fit you, but you could get it for maybe £1,000 instead of £10,000 if you didn't mind wearing a suit that was last worn by a corpse.
I love that story. That is so funny. Okay, well, let's talk about some of these trials that you have in the book, and I'm not sure which ones you actually participated in, but let me just pick one. How about the one where the woman, she claimed that she was raped by a guy who wasn't interested in her?
Yes. She was actually charged with being a stalker, and ultimately, and she tried to really ruin this doctor's reputation when she was thwarted in her interest. And so she accused the doctor of rape, and the doctor, when she was able to produce panties that had the doctor's semen on it, and that pretty much put the doctor in the frame. And then it was later determined and figured out that she had gone through the rubbish bin of the outside the doctor's apartment, and he had had his relationship with his fiance and had used a prophylactic rubber, and she had gotten that and put that semen on her panties when she took it to the police. And so but she wasn't charged with that. She was charged with stalking. And so the challenge was, she may have done this very nasty thing, but does that prove she was the person that was calling in these threatening phone calls and making threatening email messages and that sort of thing? So it was a fascinating case, and it's a little unusual to have a woman stalker too.
And in this case, you were prosecuting her for stalking.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's talk about these three burglars.
They were really a nasty crew in that they would really scope out a place, find out that the people were usually older and vulnerable, learn their routine, and they didn't do it so when they weren't home to rob the place. They did it intentionally when they were home, and it was usually late at night after midnight. And they would break in, and they would tie up the victims and threaten them with knives if they didn't disclose where their jewelry and their money was. And, of course, that usually worked. And then that insult to injury, they would sit down while the victims were tied in the chair and fix themselves a meal from the kitchen. But they were a nasty bunch. And the key to them was that their modus operandi was pretty much the same. And so they were charged with 11 counts of murder. And the evidence was pretty strong against them. But one of the more interesting aspects of that trial was the defense counsel tried to make an issue of one of the witnesses who said that one of the perpetrators had a Scottish accent, and then at another time it said it was Irish. And so he tried to make an issue of that.
He said Celtic, didn't he?
Celtic, yes,
right,
you're right.
Okay, yeah.
Celtic, and tried to make an issue of that difference. And it turned out that this guy was basically a Henry Higgins living on the Isle of Wight. And he then gave a lecture on how the accents in Scotland and Northern Ireland and how they are the different. And he ended up saying it really was a Scottish accent. And it was, we didn't know that, but it was one of those surprises. This guy just was like Henry Higgins. He could depict these different accents so readily.
I love that detail about him. Oh, he's a linguist. And these were prosecutions. These guys, they didn't kill anybody, but they were burglars. And their MO was always the same. You could tell all these burglaries had to have been committed, but they were too similar to have been done by other people. Let's talk about the one where I think you were defending a young woman who supposedly killed her baby.
Yes, that was challenging because the young woman genuinely believed that she killed her baby and smothered the baby with a pillow. And the prosecution was willing to just charge her with manslaughter, and she believing that she had actually killed her baby was willing to accept manslaughter. But there was just something about the circumstances of the case that didn't make sense that she actually did it. She may have believed she did it, but there were just facts that didn't fit. And so the concern was, should we go to trial and have her risk a murder charge or have her plead guilty to manslaughter? And a murder charge is pretty much a life sentence in England, and a manslaughter would be 7 years. So you had this interesting dynamic where your client is willing to plead guilty to manslaughter, and you don't want them to. You want them to go to trial, but you can't really encourage the client to do that because they're the ones rolling the dice. It's their life that's on the line, and so you can't really encourage them to do that. But enough evidence was generated to get a not guilty verdict from some scientific evidence about, you know, her saying she held the pillow over the baby's face for 10 seconds, and all the experts said that would be impossible. There were no injuries to the baby's face or bruises, and so the evidence, the circumstantial evidence, suggested she couldn't have done it, even though she believed it. And of course, the other challenge was you couldn't put her on the stand to testify, because if she got on the stand to testify, she would say, yes, I killed my baby. Mm-hmm. So that's another interesting challenge of a trial, when you almost have to put the client on the stand to say what didn't happen, except in this case, the client said, I did it.
These are fascinating cases. My guest is Dennis J. Turner. The book is An American Yankee in King Alfred's Court. It's fiction, but it's inspired by his own experiences. And you spend a lot of time in court, and we learn about the intricacies of that. And you also find out in the book that your mentor is dealing with a terminal illness. And it's very much lifestyle related, and yet he insists upon living this amazing life, drinking all this fabulous wine, eating all this fatty food, and you take a lot of breaks. And you spend a lot of time in Normandy in France with him and with his friends and associates. And late in the book, you go to a restaurant with him. He's very connected. He can get you in restaurants that are closed. He can get you those great meals. He can get you the finest wines. And I've seen this myself over in places like France, where, in my case, the ugly Americans come to town, and they might love France, but they don't like the French. And you describe how these guys you were with were being unkind to the French. Now, did this really happen? You were kind of upset in the book, at least your character.
Yes, that really happened. We were at a restaurant in Normandy, and it was one of the more embarrassing points in my life over there. One British guy spilled some wine, and the maitre d' said, oh, that's not a good start, or something like that. Well, he took great umbrage from that, and then for the next half hour or so, they kept speaking in English about how terrible the French were, and all the waiters and the maitre d', of course, spoke English. And then they always resort, and this happens several, many times during time over there, they always resort to World War II, and that the French got out of World War II and left us to fight the Germans alone. And no matter how often I said, you know, those folks have been dead for a long time. How can you hold it against this generation of French since they weren't even born, you know, when that happened? You may have a case to say France surrendered too early, but my gosh, can't you leave it go? But But no, they will trot that out every time.
Mm-hmm. And also late in the book, you're in Normandy, and you're really having that last magnificent feast with your mentor and with some of his friends. And there's a very pompous lawyer in that group, and there's another guy who's a wine expert. And then the pompous lawyer, there's a woman there who is planning to marry him once her divorce becomes final, and you get into a conversation with her where, well, at least your character does, where she basically says, this is the deal. This is why I'm marrying this guy.
Yes, and that is basically verbatim true. It was one of the more interesting conversations I ever had, because it was motivated when this lawyer was expounding and bragging and everything and what he owned, and I gave her the name of the book, Troy. She just kind of rolled her eyes. And so that's when I sat next to her once we moved around, and I said, I noticed you rolled your eyes. And she said, well, I guess I better get control of that if I'm going to be at the trophy wife and learn how to fawn and better. And I was just shocked. She just said, yeah, I'll be a trophy wife. And we had a conversation about what her expectations were, and she was going into all this with a very clear eye. And as she said, she was 35 years old, had four children, three or four children, and the man she was married to was a truck driver who was also a gambler, and she was divorcing him. And she said, you know, my children, if I marry this lawyer, we'll be going to the best schools, have a good chance in life. I'll have servants. And then she said, and I'm just kind of like his Rolex and his other stuff he owns, and I can flatter potential clients and solicitors and that. And then she said what was just really hit me, she is, you know, by flirting, she says, like I'm flirting with you now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought, this is a great strategy. You know, don't have any ambiguity about flirting. Just tell the guy, yeah, I'm flirting with you. And what an ego boost that is.
Wow.
But she then saw, like, she could keep this up for 15 years. And then he'll be 70 and she'll be 50. And she would be very happy and well set after those 15 years. And if he wanted to go for a younger woman at that time, it was quite all right. It was just an amazing conversation. And so, you know, straightforward and honest. It was really one of the high points of my time over there.
And very entertaining for readers. Dennis, it's been a pleasure having you back on the show.
Well, it's been, appreciate you having it. And you're such a tremendous interviewer because you ask great questions. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Dennis, and thanks for this book. It's An American Yankee in King Alfred's Court by Dennis J. Turner, who's been my guest today in the Book Nook. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.